Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and coming up on the program this week... Australian universities are in financial trouble with the loss of their overseas student stream. Now, Education Minister Dan Tehan is pushing through changes which will see humanities and business students facing increased costs for their education fees. A swarm of police were on hand to shut down a peaceful protest at the University of Sydney. Also on the program...
It's annoying and, kind of sad at the same time because I wanted to go on holidays with two of my friends. And I guess now, with the interest being low, I won't be able to do that.
Disheartened school kids that have been saving for a special event are finding that low interest rates mean that they have to lower their expectations. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Money. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has the biggest challenge any treasurer has had since the Great Depression. He's confirmed that the economy is in deep recession and has expressed his concern for the economic effects of the Victorian lockdown and border closures elsewhere. With government support measures like JobKeeper due to progressively taper off at the end of the month, I asked Warren Hogan, industry professor at the University of Technology Sydney and also former ANZ chief economist, just how much responsibility the government bore for the deepening of this recession.
Oh, look, I don't think they're responsible for the recession. I mean, they had to respond to the health crisis, and that is ostensibly what created this major downturn in the economy. So I wouldn't put responsibility at their feet. They've acted very, very promptly. They've been very decisive and swift with their policy responses to date. But they will be judged from how they get the economy out of this hole.
And one of the things that is coming up is the tapering off of the support mechanisms like JobKeeper particularly. What do you think might happen towards the end of the year?
Yeah, well, this is the first big test, isn't it? So they put in place the emergency policy programs, the extension of JobSeeker, the JobKeeper. These were all substantial injections of money into the economy, and that worked. We saw that in the latest GDP report, which showed essentially household income growing in Q2, even though the economy contracted by that record amount. The question is, when is the right time to get rid of these emergency supports? Because you have to do it to allow the economy to get back on its feet, to get the private sector up and going again. But if you do it too early, if there's still a health issue out there, you know, we could see the economy re-slump. You know, you could see a vicious cycle of job losses and contracting spending. But if you keep it in play for too long, it gets in the way of a recovery. Now, I think this government is chomping at the bit to get into the recovery phase. They're facing an election in a couple of years. They want to build some momentum. So the risk is they're doing it too early, in my view, especially after what we've seen in Victoria. And it is a significant pullback from September through to March next year. It's still in place, JobKeeper, but we'll go from 3.5 million people on it at the moment, to 2.5 million in 4 weeks' time, and then in 4 months, i.e. January 21, there'll only be a million people on it. And the question will be, how many of those people who fall off the eligibility for JobKeeper lose their job? And that's the real question.
Because some businesses also that may be kept afloat with JobKeeper, maybe they're not viable. So that we could see a proportion of businesses going under in the next 3 to 6 months. How big do you think that might be?
Look, I don't know is the honest answer. The OECD has put out a number some months ago that one in six businesses in advanced economies like ours could fail. I think that's a little bit high. But that is really the point, is that JobKeeper is as much corporate welfare as it is aimed at keeping, you know, people with income. And the other piece of this puzzle is the bank interest moratoria. So that's been extended to January next year. And banks can't actually foreclose on a business while they're in moratoria. They have no mechanism for it. It's actually not legal, I suppose. The issue then is when we finish that moratorium in January 21, JobKeeper's been wound back for 4 months by that stage. What's the state of play? And that's really the main message from someone like myself who's monitoring the economy and trying to make sense of where we're headed, is that right now we're not really looking at an economy that is sustainable. It's next year that we're going to be sort of facing the day of reckoning, that we're going to get the real insight into what the economic position is. And there will be further job losses, I believe, unfortunately, and there will be business failings in the first half of next year, and then we'll know what the challenge is.
So we're kind of in like a phony recession at the moment. We're really going to get to the crunch time beginning of next year.
That's right. And look, economists tend to focus on all the numbers and all this sort of stuff, and they're important, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's not the fall in GDP, which basically happened over 4 weeks in the middle of March to the middle of April. I mean, that was the big downturn in economic output. So we're not going to go back into recession in a technical sense. It's all about how quickly we can get back the lost economic output. We've lost 7% of economic activity in this economy, which is phenomenal. The previous largest fall in any one quarter was 2%. A typical recession involves a fall of around 3% over a period of 18 months or something like that. So we've got a long way back, and the issue is, how quickly can we get that activity back? How quickly can we get the people who are unemployed back into jobs? And yeah, that's really the test now. And it's a substantial task. It really is going to take a couple of years. I don't think we should sugarcoat that.
And Josh Frydenberg's been quite critical of the degree of lockdown, I suppose, in Victoria, and also to some extent Queensland's border closures as well. Do you think it's just a bit of party politics, or is there some truth to that?
Look, you know, it's a tough one, right? As an economist, I don't want to sort of be too heavy-handed with views on health, but you can argue that, you know, in New Zealand, the Queensland WA model is putting all their chips on a vaccine, essentially. Whereas the government's arguing, and many other countries' approach is, we have to learn to live with this, and that's the so-called COVID normal. We can't just keep locking societies down. So New South Wales is getting great experience at running the suppression strategy, at contact tracing, of being all over outbreaks, and they're having some real success, in my opinion. The other states aren't getting much practice at this. Not Queensland, not WA, and of course Victoria is in full lockdown, so it's sort of a bit of a moot point, really. And I think this is the point, is, you know, do we just have to bite the bullet and try and manage our way through this, or do we keep locking down? I mean, the cost of lockdown economically is huge, and I think there's a growing sort of voice that says the cost in terms of health is substantial. So my guess is we're heading to a point where everyone's got a sort of, you know, you could argue there's sort of a come to Jesus moment, and I'm sure the Prime Minister would like that to happen tomorrow at the National Cabinet. But I think there's also state politics. You know, the state premiers are playing on fear to some extent, and shutting the borders seems to work for them. They're going to have to just face up to the realities of COVID-19 at some stage. And I'd imagine that's the way it's going to play out by the end of the year.
One other thing that I was just noticing was that there's been reports that a lot of people actually have been saving money in this period for various reasons. They're not doing as much, and they've been able to keep some of those savings there. Is there a danger that people don't go back to spending?
There's always an issue in an economy of people sort of worried and saving too much, and yeah, and it's matched by the equal problem of people being over exuberant and spending too much and racking up heaps of debt. And, you know, we we have both problems from time to time. I think what we've seen in the second quarter of this year and the GDP numbers sort of highlight this is that the government maintained sort of household income through their stimulus payments. A lot of people still kept their job and still kept getting paid, and people stopped spending. And they stopped spending because they couldn't spend. You know, they could only buy so many jigsaw puzzles and board games and et cetera, et cetera. So there is a sort of a pent-up demand there. And we already saw it with the easing of restrictions in May and June with a sort of big bounce back in people going to restaurants and so forth. So, look, I think, you know, there is a buffer. And I think as we ease restrictions, obviously in Victoria is a big one, but even opening those borders to allow people to go on holidays. I mean, people in Australia go overseas for holidays, but then the next port of call is to go interstate. I think a lot of people who are forced to holiday within their own state borders tend to be a more modest holiday. It's not as big a deal. Well, I think that's the case right now. So, yeah, I think there's money there ready to go. The flip side of this is that government income support's going to come off and household income will slip over the course of the next 12 to 18 months. So we sort of need that buffer in there because we're not going to get any income stimulus from the government as they pull back on JobKeeper.
Well, I suppose we'll just have to keep on with the balancing act and we'll watch this space for December and January.
There's a long way to go on this one, and it is exactly as you just characterised it. It's a real balancing act between the health issues and the economic issues, and you know it's going to continue to be, I think, a very tricky economic situation. Not for everyone. A lot of people still have their jobs. A lot of people will be going about their normal sort of business as usual, but there's a lot of people who have lost their jobs, and it's going to be a lot of fear of losing jobs, and that's going to be around for at least another 12 to 18 months, in my opinion.
Warren Hogan, a business professor at the University of Technology, Sydney. And, of course, he was the former chief economist for the ANZ Bank and hence speaking with me there.
Is he right? Is he on the money?
Yes, I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to On The Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. And we do think that Warren Hogan is pretty much on the money.
On The Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Australian universities are in deep financial trouble with the loss of their overseas student money stream. Now, the Federal Education Minister, Dan Tehan, is pushing through changes which is going to see humanities and business students pay double in a new government bill, which we think went through the lower house today. And it's the biggest overhaul in university fees in more than 20 years. Students at the University of Sydney were protesting the changes and Sufia Tariq was there.
No cuts, no fees!
No corporate universities!
No cuts, no fees!
No corporate universities!
A proposed government change to university fees and funding will see the cost of arts and humanities subjects double, while job-ready subjects such as teaching, nursing and STEM subjects will cost up to 62% less. Education Minister Dan Tehan addressed the National Press Club, stating...
If they look at other units where hopefully it will help their employability, that will reduce the cost of their degree and I think improve employment outcomes for students once they finish their degrees in 3 to 4 years.
However, Liam Donoghue, University of Sydney SRC president, disagrees that the price signalling will incentivise students to change their course choices, and instead argues the even bigger issue is the overall decreased government funding to universities.
Accompanied by a reduction in government funding. So STEM fields, or what they're calling job-ready fields, are getting hit with essentially a double whammy, where the student fees are being decreased and the government funding compared to now is being decreased. And so that means that overall they have less money to deal with. So you can have more people studying STEM if you want, but the quality of the STEM education is going to decline significantly, so therefore the quality of graduates will decline significantly as well. But also there's a lot of statistical analysis which shows that there aren't really jobs in those professions anyway. So, like, for example, the government has completely gutted the CSIRO. The government has completely gutted think tanks and, you know, universities and research institutions which are responsible for employing a lot of these STEM graduates. So they're trying to churn out more people into fields which do not have capacity to take them because they sound nice and it sounds good. This is not about decreasing fees for STEM students. What this is about is decreasing funding overall, increasing fees for art students, but then at the very last second, trying to make it seem like it's a well-informed, well-researched government policy, and therefore, you know, thinking, oh, let's throw them a little bone, and decreasing STEM fees by what, 20%? Like, at the end of the day, it's just a 20% smaller HECS debt for everyone else. Right? Like, people aren't really going to notice the difference between a HECS debt that is, you know, 100 versus a HECS debt that's 120. And that's essentially what they're trying to offer us. It's a bargain, or you know, essentially a choice between a very minuscule decrease in our fees, or some people's fees, versus a significant increase in everyone else's fees, plus an overall funding deterioration for everyone else, which is going to lead to the actual death of many universities, the loss of countless jobs, the loss of diverse curricula, the loss of freedom and choice in what people want to study, and I think most importantly, just a loss in quality overall.
Students say they are already seeing the impacts on the quality of their classes. University of Sydney Education Officer Jack Mansell said.
At Sydney Uni, for example, about a week ago they announced that they're going to try and move to sack 30% of staff in the arts faculty, which will just mean even more of the same kind of shit in terms of students coming to campus, not even having a teacher for their classes. Like, I have a class which literally is every week a PDF is uploaded and you have to read that. And there's no teacher. It's just a unit coordinator who has 1 hour a week where you can contact her. So what we're seeing is just the quality of education in person are being massively degraded by sackings of permanent but also casual staff that happened last semester. And on top of that, the government is saying, while this is all happening to your education, we're going to cut $770 million in federal funding and charge you twice as much for it.
The economic impact of the coronavirus has already been seen with the decreased revenue from international students, which is likely to continue through the recession. A statement from Dan Tehan says the government has better aligned the cost to students and the taxpayer of teaching a degree with the revenue a university receives to teach that degree. However, Liam Donoghue says that it is at the cost of students.
University of Sydney, for example, provides education to domestic students at a loss. Every domestic student to whom they provide education is not generating enough revenue for them to offset the cost of providing the education to that person. The only reason they've been able to sustain the university over the past few years is because of how much they overcharge international students. And of course, now that that variable has fallen off, now that that kind of crucial linchpin has been pulled from the Jenga pile, the stacks are just falling. And you know, ultimately, it is both domestic and international students who are left to try to pick up the pieces.
The bill passed the lower house today and now awaits the Senate.
Yes, got to watch out those things on the Jenga pile. And that was Sufia Tariq on site there at the student protests at the University of Sydney. No,
doesn't make sense to me. If your dollars don't make sense, listen to On the Money.
Yep, and with interest rates left on hold by the Reserve Bank, not many people are making sense at all if they have savings in their savings accounts. were down to as low as 0.045% interest. It's a great interest rate for mortgagees, for the mortgage rates, but it's not very good if you're trying to earn money, if you're a self-funded retiree, and very little incentive for children with their first savings accounts. Aisha Janif has this story.
The Reserve Bank of Australia announced earlier this week that they have again held the historically low rate at 0.25%. Dr. Zach Gross, currently a lecturer at Monash University and previously an economist at the Reserve Bank, provides insights into what the hold means for the everyday Aussie.
Well, the idea behind the Reserve Bank of Australia cutting their interest rates is that by lowering the interest rate that banks face, this will lead to the banks in turn lowering the interest rates for Australian households and Australian businesses. So regardless of whether you're borrowing to finance a mortgage or borrowing to invest in a business, you should see lower interest rates, which means you won't have to pay quite as much in interest, which hopefully leaves more money in the pockets of Australian households and businesses. Aspect of the RBA's decision this month was to extend more financing to the banking sector. And so this additional financing should mean that banks have more money and money at a lower cost of funding to pass on to consumers in the form of cheaper interest rates and cheaper loans. So the fact that the Reserve Bank isn't winding back their support for the economy and is indeed signaled that they're going to continue to support the economy for many months, perhaps even years to come, means that Australians can take comfort that once the COVID-19 virus is contained, the government will be there to help support Australian businesses get back on their feet.
Susanna is happy that the rate cuts have been passed on because it means a little extra.
Well, I've been paying less interest from my home loan and obviously make my repayments. We have a budget, my husband and I, and we've got like expenses and then daily living expenses, obviously your groceries and all that, school fees because I've got three children. But yeah, so it just means that I have got extra money left each week.
While some consumers remain optimistic mortgage rates and other interest rates remain reduced, others have different concerns.
Low interest rates are good for the economy overall. There will be some households that don't benefit from a fall in interest rates or interest rates being kept at this low level. So for households that draw a large fraction of their income from fixed rate investments, such as retirees and pensioners, they may be at risk of having their income cut due to the low rate of the Australian economy. And so that's a potential side effect of these low interest rates that the Reserve Bank of Australia has set. And it's something that the government should look into if the problem becomes serious enough.
Dr. Zach sheds light on those that may be particularly impacted.
So as interest rates go towards zero, it does become harder and harder for, you know, banks to maintain a profit and offer, you know, a positive rate of interest to savers. So ultimately, whether it's the interest rate on your mortgage or your interest rate on your term deposits and the interest you earn on your savings, those are both going to be tied to the interest rate that the Reserve Bank of Australia sets. And when that Reserve Bank of Australia interest rate falls, you're going to see smaller interest rates, both on your mortgage payments, but also on potential income payments from any savings or term deposits you might own.
The banks have now begun slashing interest earning rates off savings accounts. Mother of three, Susanna, is concerned about the reduced earnings her children will now be subject to on their savings accounts.
Their bank accounts when they were born, and I regularly deposit money into their bank accounts. So it is purely for savings, whether it would be for their education down the track or maybe them to buy a deposit, to use it as a deposit for a home, or maybe buy their first car. Yeah, but it's purely a savings. Okay, and then being at that age now, they understand that they can see their money growing, and then, you know, interest rates have been slashed, like for savings, then disheartens them. Like, you know, they think then, well, what's the point of having a savings account if I'm not going to be earning interest?
14-year-old Sienna feels as if she may not have earned the amount anticipated by these saving rate cuts for her Commonwealth Bank account.
annoying and like kind of sad at the same time because I wanted to go on holidays with two of my friends, and I guess now, like, with the interest being low, I won't be able to do that, and I'll have a lower budget. I won't really get to experience everything. I guess COVID gets better for me.
Yes, it was 14-year-old Sienna there. I'm ending that report by Aisha Janif. And that's about it for us here on The Money. It's been great being with you this week. Yes, tune in again next week to see what we've got here for you on the world of finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers, Aisha Janif and Sufia Tarek this week. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well and thanks for your company. Melting through.